Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I am more of a visual, auditory person. Mm-hmm. I'm learning still to use words. I've been described like as a feral person, especially when I was young, and you have youth and you have collagen and
you
have...
You don't need words.
You have adrenaline.
Youth and collagen.
You don't need no, yeah.
This is Death, Sex, and Money. The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Michelle Ndegeachello has been a working musician since she was a teenager. She's 55 now and just put out her 11th solo album, her first in 5 years. It started as a kind of personal pandemic project, and now she's sharing it with the world. When we talked, she was just back from a quick European tour.
Yeah, Romania, Berlin, London. I've lost, yeah. But those are the standouts for Switzerland. Yes, standouts for me, yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a whirlwind jaunt, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've been shaken, I fear I've lost my way.
This is the song, An Invitation, from her latest album, which is called The Omnichord Real Book. Michelle's music is jazz, funk, sometimes folky, ethereal, always with a groove. She mostly splits her time between Brooklyn and outside the city in Hudson, New York, but most of her recording happens in New York City, even though she finds the place pretty overwhelming.
This band don't work for me. I'm really not listening to the rhythm of New York.
Uh-huh.
To be honest, yeah. It's hard. It's hard for me. The noise. I have very sensitive auditory systems. So that's hard for me. I try to adjust my humanity to fit within this rhythm and system. You know, I just try to create something for myself.
And is it that you notice things that other people can tune out, or how would you describe how it works?
Oh, very. I like the way you put that. It's the inability to tune out. I'm just taking in all that I hear, and then it just becomes a cacophony, and I I sometimes struggle to discern and focus. That's why I really enjoy silence.
Michelle grew up in the Washington, D.C. area in the 70s and 80s, surrounded by music. And she found the bass by chance.
My father was a jazz musician, and my brother was a budding musician. He played guitar. And his friend left a bass over. And prior to that, I had tried the clarinet. I tried playing in, like, more traditional ensembles. And my father even tried to find me an instructor. But when his friend left the bass over and I could see that I could play with my brother, and at that time, Chic was a very popular band, which is made of a bass and guitarist, and a band called GQ that I loved, and the go-go scene, it was just, I knew this instrument would allow me to play with other people and make things.
It's interesting to me that it was by chance that you picked up the bass, because I think of bass players as, you know, you don't, like, the bass player, like, is usually in the back, not the center of attention, but they're the ones setting the tone and setting the groove for the entire room, but maybe in a way that you don't always notice. There's a quiet forcefulness, I feel like, to bassist. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I hear that generalization about us. I mean, we're all different.
Right.
Trust me. I mean, you know, like Thundercat does not want to be in, you know, sitting in the back. Uh-huh. So we're all different. I do think of the bass, though, as the bridge between the magic of harmony and the power and heartbeat and life of rhythm, the drummer. Mm. And so I think without the bass player, the other two things are just abstractions, you know, and they're show-offy in a way, where the bass player is content in solidifying what's already there.
Yeah, I love...
I'm not show-offy, but without me, you're two separate abstractions.
You know, yes, I mean? Just didn't want to sound like an asshole. But that's what I'm really want to say. I was trying to be like, ooh, how do I say it? Like, I'm confident about that.
And I will tell you, when I was first listening to Michelle as a kid, when she burst on the scene in the 90s, I loved the way she made her presence known. This is Makes Me Wanna Holler from her 1996 album, Peace Beyond Passion.
Make me wanna holler. Sadness fills my heart.
Make me wanna holler.
Make me wanna holler.
Make me wanna holler.
You've talked about teaching yourself how to play music and in part doing that by listening to Prince records.
Yeah.
Can you help me picture this? Like, where would you do this and which songs do you remember?
Oh, wow. At that time, I lived in Maryland, a suburb outside of Southeast Washington. And it was like our first house that had like a rec room. Mm-hmm. And so in that room, my father... he collected stereo equipment, and so there's this great stereo, and I had an amp and a bass, and I would just sit and play the records over and try to emulate the bass line, meaning I taught myself to play by ear, mm-hmm. by listening, instead of reading music.
Yeah.
And then I remember going to a party, and it was his first record, and I heard it, and it just was the moment I knew that's what I was going to do with my life.
Wow.
I just wanted to be able to play and organize music in a way that was palpable, or like it you could dance to it, it felt good, it was interesting, and I just was, my mind was blown. Like you could, it was a palpable experience hearing the layering of the vocals. It was like choir music almost. Mm. I don't know if I would play that first tune. It's called For You on his first record.
Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just really influenced my psyche. It showed me the power of the human voice and harmony, and just really spoke to me in a deep way. And I think I was learning, yeah, the power of that particular modality, you know, sexuality and rhythm, dance, cultivating a space of enchantment, which music does. He enchanted me. He taught me enchantment.
And teenage Michelle, she dug in. This song is from her first album in 1993, Digging You Like an Old Soul Record.
Remember back in the day when everyone was black and conscious, down for the struggle. That brought us all together. Sit back and talk, cultivating a positive vibe. Blue lights in the basement. Freedom was at hand and you could just taste it. It was so cool.
Digging on me.
The music scene in D.C. became her scene.
I played like 5 nights a week. I played in go-go bands and cover bands, the pep rally band.
Uh-huh.
I had a teacher that changed my life. Her name was Mary Cole, and she taught at Oxon Hill High School, and she also taught my brother, and she had a band called Malaika. Mm. And it was a training ground for me to be the musician, the band leader that I tried to be in my beginnings. I owe it all to her guidance, you know.
So that's cool. Is she still living?
Yes. I got an email from her the other day. She's quite old, so I know, as long as the emails keep coming. But we have a really, you know, she was there for my brother and I, my family. I grew up in a very tumultuous household, and it was Mary Cole who just, you know, came to my rescue, always instilling in me curiosity about music, you know. Like, I remember her having the record for the concert for Apartheid.
Oh.
And that being my first, you know, seeing and hearing music from that continent and that diaspora. She always expressed upon me, like, read. Like, just try to force yourself to, you know, enjoy fiction and other sort of literature to, you know, just keep your mind going. And also, like, there was always, people saw in me a hope that I would go to college. And so, yeah, I thank her so much for giving me skills, because I'm very much an autodidactic. I did not really excel in school. It was a very difficult environment for me. But with her, she gave me skills that I use till this day.
Hmm. She must be very proud of you.
Oh, I hope so. She's come to see me play. Like, my mother his own would not come see me play. Mm. I think she came once and stayed for like 5 minutes. But Mary Cole has always been just extremely supportive to all my endeavors.
You say that's your boyfriend, you say I'm out of line. Funny, he said I could call him up anytime. You could call me wrong, say that I ain't right. But if that's your boyfriend, he wasn't last night. I'm the kind of woman, I'll do almost anything to get what I want. I might play any little game. Call me what you like, but you know it's true. You're just jealous, cause he wasn't with you. Don't mean no harm. I just like what I see, and it ain't my fault if he wants me. Got what I wanted, and the feeling was right. If that's your boyfriend, he wasn't last night.
This is another great song from her debut album called If That's Your Boyfriend. For Michelle, after high school, the responsibilities of adulthood came quickly.
I had a baby at 20. By 21, I moved to New York.
Michelle fell into the scene there and made new artist and musician friends in New York, people with industry connections. Her demo cassette got passed around, and she quickly signed a record deal.
It literally just lined up like that. because I had a child, and I think I tried to see what it would be like to be with the other, my child's, you know, other, I don't even know what to call that person because we have absolutely nothing, there's nothing between us.
This is the other parent of your child?
So, yeah. Uh-huh. And so I just knew like I, whatever was going to happen for my life and my son is on me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure it comes across as swagger, but I think it's more like a mountain climber. I just have the will to survive. Mm-hmm. I often tell people I'm a mediocre musician, but I'm an idea person, and I listen, and I think that's what's gotten me so far. Hmm. I just have the will and the curiosity and a compulsion to make music.
Are you saying that part of what was propelling you in that early time in New York was feeling like you needed to earn to take care of your kid?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I grew up with a depressed parent. My mother was severely depressed. And my father was like an amazing man in the sense of shiny, very compelling, and very talented and enchanting. That word's been coming up for me. But there was another side, too, that was just chaos, utter chaos. So what, yeah, between the depression and having to depend on my father or having the thought of having to depend on a man just really, I think, ignited in me. Yeah, just like I had to create my own world. Mm-hmm. And I think the mechanism for surviving a lot of the experiences of childhood was to go within myself, within my imagination, and create. It is my solace. Mm. It is the one thing that I count on. And I know that it is a gift from the creator, because it just has been something that I don't question it. It's the only thing I don't question.
I can hear you. I can touch. I can feel you.
Coming up, Michelle on the strange experience of being a famous musician, only some of the time.
When I have the bass and I'm on stage, people see me as one thing. But in my neighborhood in Carroll Gardens, most people think I'm the nanny. Or, you know, we were somewhere and I would get on the elevator and people would, you know, get off. You know, so it's like I'm just at a place in my life where the only thing I have control over is my state of being. And I'm really enjoying the dance I'm having with myself.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. If you don't yet know Michelle and Dave Gaiocello's music well, I'm pretty sure you've heard this one.
And everything is so complete. When you're walking out on the street, and the wind that catches your feet, it says you fly.
Wild Night, her and John Mellencamp's cover of the Van Morrison song. It's her biggest hit. It peaked at number 3 on the Billboard Top 100 in 1994. And for Michelle, this was a wild time of the world opening up in a lot of ways. She was connecting with Muslim teachers and converted to Islam. There was romance. She was on MTV. It all felt great at first.
I didn't listen well, and I think that's why, you know, I'm trying to find my record contract because I literally signed, you know, my life away because I was just happy. I was content that you wanted to hear my music. Mm-hmm. And I think for a decade of making music, that's where the contentment came from. So whatever I have to do that, okay. I was not very business savvy. I was not very socially savvy. Because luckily I'm naive in a sense, or I'm not a master of the social cues. I'm like a bull in a china shop. I've had to like just like learn a few things. And I'm glad I have, and I'm glad now I can see there's a way that dominant culture works. There is a way that the music business works. I'm no longer rail against it. I just see it for what it is.
Uh-huh. Was there something that happened after that decade where you realized that it was not just enough to be given the opportunity to make music?
Yes. 9/11 was a real changing experience for me. I flew the day before on the same plane to do a Fashion Week show. It was a surreal experience. And I just remember I got to the hotel on the 10th, evening of the 10th. And then I got to this hotel, and it was one of the fanciest hotels I'd ever been in my life. And I remember on the back of the door, you could see the price of the room, and it was some exorbitant amount that my mind just was just blown, and it was like just an evening of extravagance. And so I'm there, and then I wake up the next morning, and there's no water, there's nothing, there's chaos. And I remember hearing people say things that were mind-blowing to me. Like, what do you mean we're not going to have the show? Or can't you just send a helicopter and pick me up? Like, it taught me about wealth and just... It just was like a surreal experience. And then I ran to the middle of Times Square because the hotel was on 6th Avenue. And I watched the first tower fall, like in real time, like not on a screen.
Yeah, you witnessed it.
And it was just like we're all in Times Square as if it's New Year's Eve. And I made one call to the person who I loved and I believe loved me at that time, and I got through. I just marked that as the beginning my life changed.
Wow.
Just, it was like the beginning where I'm stuck here. I'm literally stuck in this city. Where am I going to go? What is going to happen? All seems so meaningless. Mm-hmm. And as a musician or as someone who's sensitive to that, it's just that, yeah, the feeling, and to watch people's worlds change and perceptions of the world change. That's when I think that's a big marker for me.
Yeah.
Plus, I had a recording that was going to come out, and I was in the hijab, and then they were like, you cannot put that out.
Oh.
You know, it was just like a moment for me where you just see, like, this is entertainment. And I don't think I want to be an entertainer. Mm. I want to be a musician. Mm. I want to be a really good musician and songwriter. I want to be a really good person. I know the power of music. It's like you're given a sword and you're just out there willy-nilly waving it around. Yes, I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, but yeah, I just know the power. I'm learning the power of the sound waves and the power of the word and the human voice its effect on your molecular structure and its ability to bring about a memory. Like, there's nothing more powerful than a love song. Like, I'm a cry right now. Like, there is music that I can hear, and it just transports you like a time machine to that moment.
Thanks for the bird. There's no foolproof plan. You can be what a woman. You gotta die like a man.
Thanks for the bird. We all want someone to blame. But when you go, you're gonna stay. We live a lie day after day.
And it hurts.
Remember the
There was a period of time where I just didn't do anything. I just stopped.
How long was that period of not doing anything?
Like 5-6 years till the accountant was like, you have nothing. You have made it to zero. Nothing's happening. So...
And that period of rest, was that in your 30s, that period of stepping away completely?
So, you know, I had a bad reputation. Mm. I was just like a loose cannon. And, you know, so I just stopped. Mm-hmm. And then I think my partner now, I praise her. I'm so grateful just to have the patience to aid me in my endeavors and clarity, and as learning to take responsibility for my actions. I am not special. Just because they give you free beer at the bar because they like your songs means nothing. And, you know, I just try to care for the people who are kind enough to, like, not blow smoke up my arse and treat me like a human being.
Do you feel like you still, both of your parents are gone. Do you feel like you're still in relationship with them? Is that how you experience it?
Oh, not anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. I think this new recording is me letting that go. It's like, I mean, I have their ashes on my altar. I'm with them every day. This is for the last few years. Hmm. Physically more than I was. I mean, I left my house as soon as I could. Mm-hmm. But the relationship I have now is one of knowledge and educating myself about being human, because I have to really humble myself and understand that my parents are people of color who were born before civil rights from in the South and have had an experience that I can't fathom. And I don't know what they were equipped with. And I think reading The Fire Next Time changed that for me. My mother had a fourth grade education. I taught my mother how to read. Hmm. My father was a frustrated musician who joined the military. And in the Baldwin book, I never forget, it's like he talks about how men go to the military and they're ruined. You ruin their humanity. And I think, my father came back very disillusioned. Also an alcoholic to deal with the pain. It's not the center of my being, but I'm no longer rolling through my life thinking that systematic racism did not have an effect on my family and how I grew up and the perception I have of myself.
In Michelle's life now, she's raising her younger 13-year-old son with her partner, Allison. They've been married since 2005. Michelle's older son, Solomon, is 34.
I thank my son, Solomon, every day. Every day of my life, he made me a better person. There's so many things I wish I could have done differently, But like having a child at 20 and with no preparation, if I could do it all again, I think I would, just in the terms of what I like, exposing him to certain like situations, not going on tour a lot and having to leave him with people I loved. I know he was safe, but I know that was hard. Also moving around a lot and not allowing him to create certain sort of relationships in high school. Like, they're not regrets, they're just something I see as like, oh, I see how this works with the child. But I think it's made him, like, he's a fantastic traveler. And he is just, like, he's the ambassador of love and a good time. He's modular. He can go anywhere. He's culturally fluent, you know? And so I hope he appreciates that. And then with my youngest, because he is not from my body, he's from my two, like, people I love so dearly. He may not come from my body, but he is my creation. And the love I have for him is a love that is, I feel like I see him for him. I don't attach it to my ego. Like, I have to see him for him and him only. Unlike with my son, with my first son out of my body, I think there was a lot of like, okay, this happened in my family and I can't let you be like that. Like, there was a lot of like projection. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of osmosis. I do see aspects of my personality. But I, as a parent, I make this joke. I read it in a New York Times article, where some people are furniture makers. I'm more of a gardener. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what seeds I've planted, but I try to just cultivate it and water it and give it enough sun, prune it. I'm not angry at it when it pricks me with its thorns. You know, I just try to be there, which I'm learning with all human interactions. I just want to be there for you. And in my absence, that you know that I care immensely.
I've been saying things I don't believe. I've been doing things that just ain't me.
Well, is it me?
Been knowing that this can't continue, but I keep on living the same way. So far ahead, I live the past and I'd rather pretend
it isn't real.
I have like a very, it's kind of an embarrassing question and it's a personal question.
Hit me.
I'm, you know, as somebody like you make art and you have made art that you have been proud of, and you also have made, you've like continually tried to make art in like evolving in different ways. And you've talked about like trying to get to that beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. And when I think of that, I think there's a particular creative challenge for people who have found some success, made something that was beautiful, shared it with people, and then they have to try to do it again. It can be really scary, especially if you're trying to do it in a new way.
Mm.
Like, when you think about trying to make music in a way that's not derivative of past ways you have found external validation or success, what do you focus on? How do you get to that place?
I don't really think about that, Anna, to be honest. Just like, everything you just said is just like, who thinks like that?
I do. It's so embarrassing.
Or like, yeah, I'm going to rest on my laurels. So yeah.
No, it's not resting on laurels. It's being afraid of losing ground after building something you're proud of. Do you know that's sort of more of the feeling that I have?
Okay.
But it sounds like it doesn't resonate, that question.
Like my mind doesn't even, I can't even frame my thought to that. I just am like, there's no encore. Bear with me. I think authenticity is unsustainable. I just want to say that first.
Huh. What's that mean?
I just try to be like really in the moment with the music. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. It really isn't. And I just come to every conversation that I'm having with myself in the music with the intention of just being present in any work I do. It's not like I'm trying like stay authentic, because I think that's unsustainable too. That's like a character you put on. But honestly, I think I thrive on naivete, a loss of brain cells, and I truly am a person, I walk in faith. I really believe even what I hear is a transmission. I just wait for the transmission. And some of them I have to set aside, but I always make music. I draw, I paint, I try to, I am driven to, I'm driven by self-expression because I feel so trapped in this material experience.
That's Michelle and Daggiacello. Her latest album is called The Omnicord Real Book. We used lots of songs from it in this episode, and it's nominated for the Best Alternative Jazz Album Grammy Award this year. You can see all the music of hers we used in our episode transcript at deathsexmoney.org. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Andrew Dunn, with help from Afi Yellowduke. The rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Zoe Azoulay, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our intern is Ellie McKay, whom we are saying goodbye to this week. Thank you, Ellie, and best of luck in all that's next. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. Subscribe to our weekly newsletter if you haven't already. I write a weekly essay there. And as we've told you, our show is in transition here at WNYC, and we'll share updates about the future of the show there as we learn them, along with other things that the team and I are thinking about. Sign up to get that newsletter every week at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. Thank you to Marjorie Nicholson Albers in Kalispell, Montana, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. We couldn't do this without you, Marjorie, and all of our sustaining members. Thank you. As Michelle and I ended our conversation, I asked her whether she had artist role models now in this stage of life, and she told me she doesn't really, and she's on the lookout.
I am desperate, actually, to find mentorship. At my age, I don't have a lot of elder women in my life. So the things that are happening to my body are really interesting, and I wish I had people to talk to about it.
I think I noticed this morning that Chaka Khan had commented on an Instagram post of yours. So maybe you should send her a DM.
I love her. Oh my God. Are you? Oh my God.
We all should make a brunch date.
Oh, yeah. That'd be awesome. Oh my God. Wow.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return.
Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.